Welcome back to GI Pearls. It's another wonderful day out here in New England. The rain's finally gone, and this is a summary of the GI literature for the first 2 weeks of June. June's finally here. Oh, and I just purchased the domain name gipearls.com, so you can find all the episodes, show links, and everything else out there. One thing I noticed that if you click on view full description of the episode on the iPhone, you can actually get the links to individual articles that I mentioned. So feel free to use that to look up the article directly. You can follow me on Twitter, by the way, at @GI_pearls. So let's move on to the articles then. So there is another article in the category, Does This Do a Darn Thing in the GIE this month? Indomethacin and diclofenac in the prevention of post-ERCP pancreatitis. Love this topic. And this is a systematic review and meta-analysis of prospective controlled trials. This one has about 4,000 patients, almost 5,000, 17 trials, and diclofenac or indomethacin significantly decreased the risk of PEP. The risk ratio here is 0.6 with a 95% confidence interval. So use of rectally administered diclofenac or indomethacin before or closely after ERCP is inexpensive and is recommended to every patient. So nothing new here. Another trial showing that post-ERCP pancreatitis may be prevented with an indomethacin. What's interesting here is that most American and European gastroenterologists have not applied any NSAIDs for PEP prophylaxis, which to me was a revelation. And that may have something to do with me being raised in the Northeastern academic bubble. The very next paper in this issue of GIE is also very interesting, and it speaks about retention of video capsule endoscopy capsules. And this is a meta-analysis of about 5,800 patients, 25 different papers. And overall, there are a few very interesting conclusions that I'll summarize for you here. Number one is the overall rate of retention of capsules, about 2%, which is what I thought it was in the past, so that's good. Half of all retentions were due to stricturing disease, which is another kind of a known, but it's interesting to know that the other half doesn't happen in patients with stricturing disease, which is interesting. And half of all retentions were managed surgically. But the most interesting finding is the fact that majority of patients with retained capsules never have any symptoms. And that's kind of a known, but nonetheless, good to see this summarized in almost 6,000 patients. So the very next paper in this GIE issue is again very interesting. The title is Natural History of Diminutive and Small Colorectal Polyps, a Systematic Literature Review. So many people estimate that removing all visible polyps reduces your CRC mortality by about 50%. And here I'm just going to quote from the paper. Unfortunately, it is unknown whether removal of all diminutive 1 to 5 millimeter and small 6 to 9 millimeter polyps contributes significantly to this reduction. Basically, are we saving lives by removing large polyps only, or do small polyps removal also makes a difference? So what exactly happens to a polyp, say an adenoma, if it's left in the colon for 2 to 3 years for one reason or another? You know, overall, the real reason these folks are studying this is interval cancer occurrence, I think. I don't know about you, but most of the polyps I remove, probably over 80%, are small, 1 to 9 millimeters. So now let's go straight to the conclusions of the paper. And I quote here, in our systematic literature review of 9 studies and 1,034 adenomas sized 1 to 9 millimeters that were observed for 2 to 3 years for most studies, only one polyp might have progressed to CRC. Once again, 1,000 adenomas, 1 to 9 millimeters, one polyp progressed to CRC in 2 to 3 years. So what happened to the rest? Did they grow? Yeah, about 6% of them grew to advanced adenomas over the 2 to 3 years observation time in this paper. And do the polyps fall off? Many people think that they do. In this paper, they had 4 studies, between 2 to 14% of observed polyps appeared to resolve completely. What about SSPs? Well, this paper doesn't really talk about it because they only 3 small SSPs in the whole study. And the paper goes on to say, currently, we are not able to predict which polyps will progress or remain stable. Outcomes from these prospective studies show a rather benign course of unresected 1 to 9 millimeter adenomas within 2 to 3 years follow-up. Basically, most polyps do nothing to the 2 to 3 years away. And then there's an accompanying editorial titled, Time to Reduce the Burden of Removing Diminutive Polyps in Colorectal Cancer Screening. Basically arguing that most of the polyps are removed do nothing. I think overall this is good news, probably for those companies that are making disposable self-propelled diagnostic scopes. Because if you ain't got large polyps, you're probably okay for a few years. I'll certainly be looking at what people have to say about this interesting paper, maybe in letters to the editor.
So there's another article on air insufflation versus carbon dioxide insufflation in this issue of GIE as well. It's from South Korea and actually looks at inpatients rather than outpatients. So diagnostic workup colonoscopies rather than screening. And no surprise there, there's less pain associated with the use of CO2. And basically, the percentage of patients with a zero pain score about an hour after colonoscopy goes from around 20% with air to about 40% with CO2. And this is a randomized double-blind trial. So the evidence for CO2 use is adding up. So far, I've been to two centers where they transitioned from using air to using CO2, and there's a lot less pain. Everybody should be using CO2 probably at this point. So the next paper is for microbiome lovers out there. This one is from Nature, and it's metformin and its effects on the gut microbiome of individuals who are treatment-naive type 2 diabetics. So what they did is basically gave people metformin or placebo, look at the microbiome. So there's a big difference between the two. And then they actually transplanted the microbiome of patients who were metformin into mice and saw that the microbiota transplant actually improved glucose control in these mice. So initially I thought this was just another case of a surrogate marker, so maybe not. And that kind of brings up a point of all these microbiome studies which are coming out these days. Many of them are very interesting, so lots of new ideas need to be explored. Moving on to the Red Journal, there's an interesting article in there about fundic gland polyps. We all see them, we all remove them, and most of the time they come back as benign, but once in a while we get FGPs with dysplasia. So what do you do about that? So many times we think about FAP as an association with fundic gland polyps with dysplasia, but is that really the case for the incidentally found fundic gland polyps with dysplasia? So this paper looked at 25 incidental FGPs with dysplasia in patients not known to have FAP. So they looked over the data for these 25 patients and saw that about 4.5 years later, they had no clinical evidence of FAP on colonoscopies. There's no gastric cancers. There were no deaths or surgery in these patients. 11 of the patients were actually sequenced for APC and MUTYH germline mutations, and none of them have it. So the bottom line here is that if you find a fundic gland polyp with some dysplasia, probably you don't need to do a follow-up genetic counseling or testing, unless you have any other data to kind of think about genetic testing. But fundic gland polyp with dysplasia alone is not enough. The next paper comes from BMJ, and the title is Long-Term Gluten Consumption in Adults Without Celiac Disease and Risk of Coronary Heart Disease. And basically, the conclusion is that long-term intake of gluten is not associated with risk of coronary heart disease. And that's great. Although I'm not a big fan of dietary studies in general, especially when there are surveys. And this was based on a National Health and Nutrition Examination survey. But it's good news that eating gluten probably is not going to give you a heart attack. So I guess that's good news. But can you imagine just the news reports and all the consequences of this study that was actually associated with an increase in coronary heart disease? It would have been a disaster. So I'm happy that the study is negative. The next two articles come from the category of the big questions in GI. Number one being, are PPIs killing us? And the second one is, C. diff, how do we prevent it in hospitalized patients? So going with the C. diff story, this article is from Gastroenterology, and it's titled, Timely Use of Probiotics in Hospitalized Adults Prevents C. diff Infections, a Systematic Review with Meta-Regression Analysis. And the authors basically conclude there's a 50% reduction in the risk of C. diff infection in hospitalized patients when you administer probiotics to these patients, quote unquote, in a timely manner. And I've heard of this before where several hospitals actually started giving probiotics routinely to patients who are on antibiotics in hopes of preventing C. diff. But there's a little bit of a problem there. I think probiotics is a big category, and you know, government regulation of probiotics in the US is very complex. Depending on the probiotic product, the FDA might regulate it as a dietary supplement, food ingredient, or a drug. And most probiotics sold in the US, I think, do not require FDA approval before they're marketed. So what do we give to patients? Well, this review kind of gives you a few recommendations as what you should be giving to the patients. But obviously, a word of caution, this is a meta-analysis and not a randomized trial, once again. And what's interesting, one of the figures in this paper is interesting, is that they listed all the studies from 1989 to 2016 and kind of showed whether risk ratio form favors experimental or control. And it looks like probiotics are getting better, or we're just preventing C. diff at a better rate with these probiotics every year, which is interesting. But in the end, 50% reduction is nothing to laugh at. Perhaps as we better define what probiotic really is, and once we regulate better the production of such and standardization of what we actually give to the patient, we may prevent some of the infections.
Moving on to the PPIs, there's a great review of all the complications of PPI therapy in this month, Gastro. And it even has a cool graphic of everything that PPI have been linked to. PPIs, and just to summarize, PPIs have been linked to stroke, dementia, pneumonia, MIs, SLE, rhabdo, funding gland polyp, acute interstitial nephritis, ESRD, C. diff infections, salmonella, campylobacter, microscopic colitis, osteoporosis, and small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. And once again, the bottom line here is that the evidence for PPI's harm is too weak to recommend stopping these medicines in patients who truly need them. Now, the big question is who really needs them. A friend of mine recently told me that him going on a PPI actually stopped him from doing all sorts of lifestyle changes that he otherwise would have done. And stopping his PPI after a few months of use actually resulted in some weight loss because he started eating less things that caused him to have GERD. And just to go back to the C. diff story and probiotics story, there is a paper from Lancet Infectious Diseases which proposes an entirely different way to fight C. diff infections in the hospital. I think it's a much more effective way, and that's by preventing infection in the first place. How does one do that? Their answer is antibiotic stewardship programs, which are fantastic, as annoying as they are. Now, this is a meta-analysis, so take it with a grain of salt, but the idea is still great. They looked at 32 studies. Collectively, there was a 50% reduction in MRSA and gram-negative infections, and there was a 32% drop in C. diff infections as a result of these antibiotic stewardship programs. So these programs, as sometimes as annoying as they are probably saving lives out there, and I think a much better way of reducing C. diff than adding probiotics with every antibiotic you decide to prescribe. That's it for GI Pearls for the first 2 weeks of June. Feel free to leave comments and suggestions on the website, gipearls.com. Follow me on Twitter, gi_pearls. Send me interesting articles for review or otherwise. If you found this podcast on the web, you can always subscribe to it on iTunes. Have a great day.